Brian O'Driscoll on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Now then, you're welcome along. It's Wednesday night rugby. There is much to discuss. Champions Cup launch over in Cardiff today, minus Saracens, who've elected not to show up given their unhappiness with their 35 points deduction and their £5 million fine pending appeals. We're going to talk about that. Johnny Sexton's on the way. He was talking to Neil Tracy, who was over at the launch. He was, as you might imagine, not in great form. We have Pro 14 on the way this weekend. We have Champions Cup on the way next weekend. And Brian O'Driscoll, we have a World Cup final to look back on. You're very welcome.
Thanks. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Plenty going on. Yeah.
Nice and bronzed.
It's been a while. Yeah, yeah. I've been getting away for a few weeks. So at what point did ITV turn around to you and Paul O'Connell and say, look, we kind of thought you were going to do a bit better here. That's why we brought both of you out. So just make yourselves useful for the next couple of weeks as best you can.
It's the, we'll find work for you somewhere. Yeah. Hang on. You're a very, very valuable component of our team. Obviously, I think in advance of us going over there, they thought that Ireland were going to get to a semi-final. And as a result, they wanted to stock up on a couple of ex-Irish players. Alan Quinlan, a voice as well. Mm. In comms. So when that didn't materialise, I think both Paulie and myself probably looked at each other and kind of thought, what next? And you know, the other factor was that we'd lots of Welsh pundits, we'd lots of English pundits. So they didn't have that many South Africans, so that's probably why both of us ended up doing the final.
Yeah. And, well, the final, 32 points to 12. It was dominant in the end. England not very good, it must be said, in some respects as well. So talk to us here, what happened?
England just started really badly. First of all, you know, there was talk of them being 20 or 25 minutes late. There hasn't been much around that, but I was pit side with Clive Woodward and Johnny Wilkinson, and they walked out, Owen Farrell walked out a little less than an hour before kickoff for the first time. I could see Johnny visibly twitching at the thought of not having an hour and a half or an hour and 45 minutes warm up.
He in particular mightn't deal well with that.
No, but also Johnny was different than everyone. Where most teams are an hour and 20, an hour and a half, he was like, he liked almost 2 hours, which I'm sure would have had a negative impact on certain other players that didn't want to be there beforehand, but Johnny liked 40 minutes of warming up with Dave Allred or whoever the other 10s were. So as we watched Owen Farrell come out, looked very relaxed, very casual, and there was no stresses. The English team warmed up really well by us. They looked calm, and you know, the few boys that I would have known gave a knowing kind of nod to. So they looked as though they were ready for it. But I feel as though they had mapped out certain areas that they could go after South Africa, and their inaccuracies in those areas cost them. Like the small impacts, like giving away a penalty in the first 30 seconds. Mm. Courtney Law is not rolling away. Like, he's got to fight to get away from that. You get trapped in there, players will try and tie you in. You've got to fight like a salmon being picked off by a bear to try and wriggle for freedom. And
it's a wonderful image.
Thank you. Thank you. It just came to me. But you've got to fight, and he didn't. And anyway, they missed that one. Yeah. The Sinclair issue, injury has a real negative impact, obviously.
Is he a big deal in the scrum? Sorry.
Not really. Yeah. And I wouldn't know this personally. This was through asking ex-players, and particularly ex-front rowers, talking about Dan Cole would probably be considered to be the better scrummager, but Sinclair's overall play would have him out in front, and comfortably out in front these days. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of a case of we will never know how Sinclair would have dealt with Beast, whether he would have worked him out a little bit quicker than Cole did. Mm-hmm. But the reality was the scrum was a nightmare and was the winning and losing of the game ultimately, because...
And is it ultimately that simple?
I think still? It was. Yeah. Like Billy Vunipoloff, a scrum in for the first 3 points, England 22. They were retreating, but he took it, as usually would carry into the 10-12 channel, but he threw a loose pass out the back, went to ground. Mm. Farrell picked it up and then got turned over by Vermeulen, and an easy 3 points for Pollard. So it's just a very uncharacteristic England performance where you've got to take on the fight. First of all, you can't get too clever and start playing sevens, particularly against a team that in a World Cup final you still have to work out. Mm. and understand what way they're coming at you, whereas it felt as though they tried to play too much too soon. There's another line out 5 minutes in, I think their first line out, where they went to sweep down the blind side. They'd obviously analysed that Mapimpi was going to defend a particular way, or Faf de Klerk stays on the edge. And as it unfolded, South Africa actually stayed off and didn't really commit huge numbers up to them. And Youngs threw this kind of floater over the top of Watson and into touch.
Yeah.
And it just looked as though it took the wind out of their sails and they never got going.
It was as if they were a team getting a sense, this isn't actually going to be our day early on.
Yeah, it did. It felt like that. And whether, you know, if that is true about the... And people might think, oh, the bus 20 minutes late, oh, excuses, excuses. But it's just a reinforcement of, oh, gosh, this isn't actually how it was due to go to plan. We've thought about this all week. We've thought about how the game progresses and how we build a lead and how we score early. And all of a sudden, we're not doing that. Mm. And now we're getting dragged into the arm wrestle that everyone said, don't get involved with South Africa. That's how they'll beat you up. And all of a sudden, they were in that game, down to set piece. So South Africans' stats over the course of the World Cup at line-out were incredible. Mm-hmm. Up to the final, they'd lost one. I'm not even sure if they lost one in the final. So one over the course of a tournament, a scrum that smashed England, picked up five scrum penalties in the first half. Mm-hmm. You just cannot live with set piece like that. Mm-hmm. I don't care what team you are.
So did the England game plan against New Zealand versus what they tried to do against South Africa, are they pretty similar, or did they try?
It's hard to know. I don't think they were similar. Yeah, similarly to New Zealand, you know, against us versus against England, we don't really know. You know, it's probably similar game plan, certain tweaks and modifications because of the defensive system you would have been playing. I think England would have felt they could have gotten the edge because there were question marks around Lucanio Am at centre, and people were saying, oh, he's very sketchy in defence. Suddenly, he almost had a man of the match performance defensively and in attack. So I feel as though they were trying to get at him and Mapimpi. And they never had an opportunity. They didn't get enough ball. Mm. They didn't get any real possession because their territory was starved with the penalties they were giving away. Mm. And that it was at 6-3. Was it 6-3? No, it was 9-3. And they're hammering away at the South African line. And it felt as though that was a seminal moment in the game. Whereas if they'd picked up a try and gotten, you know, converted it all of a sudden, you know, 10-9, and then the confidence start coming. They got a three-pointer and they knocked it over, but then South Africa got a quick riposte and were 6 points ahead again. So they just never had got a foothold on the game. And the longer it went on, the more South Africa looked as though they were in control because it was at their pace.
There was a brief moment in that spell just after half-time. I think it was around then Marler came on and they won that scrum in a big way. You know, they kept running for about 20 metres after they won it. And Farrell did have the chance to kick them back to within three.
Mm.
And he missed it, just pushed it wide of the right-hand post. And from then on, it really felt like that was their chance gone, whatever momentum they briefly had.
And we'd been saying, well, I'd been saying that, you know, for the first time ever, I thought I was going to be supporting England because I didn't want to see a team winning the manner in which South Africa did against Wales in the semi-final. It wasn't good for rugby. I guess I was able to accept the result a lot easier because of how South Africa went and played in the final. Mm-hmm. They didn't actually... they went wide, but they went wide most of the time on penalty advantage when they knew they could play. And Garcés is someone that likes to play 6-7 phases of advantage sometimes, so you know you have the ability to go and play. And rather than just do that kick contest thing when penalty advantage and go for a 50-50 hit and hope, they actually tried to create. And Willy Leroux probably... did I hear him saying to... Rassie Erasmus that he was going to have his best game of the tournament, and sure enough he did. The centres were very good. D'Alande was very good again, but their passing game was, for the first time since the opening 20 minutes of the All Black game, we got to see it, and they had England stressed.
How do you explain that? I mean, people were saying, oh well, maybe they're even holding things back in a semi-final. Now that semi-final
I don't know why they would have done that.
It was not a comfortable enough semi-final to hold anything back. You know, they needed everything they had that day.
I think they obviously were disappointed themselves in their own performance, that as much as they wanted to have a simplified game plan, I think no one would enjoy playing that style. Nobody.
It was incredibly grim. I mean,
it was awful viewing. It was the best decision I made of the 3 weeks away. I was asked whether I wanted to go to the game or not. And I said, oh, it'll be a 6 or 7 hour day. I just watch it on the portal back on my iPad. Phenomenal decision.
There was a point in that game where I thought, if I have to look at Faf de Klerk stand at the back of a ruck over a ball for 6 seconds again, I may never watch rugby. You know,
it was an awful advertisement. And I was doing a bit of tweeting during the game and got in some, you know, contact with some South Africans. And for the most part, they were in agreement. You know, they weren't trying to tell me something that I wasn't seeing. They were saying it was awful. We got the job done. Hopefully it'll be more in the final. And sure enough, it was. But Faf de Klerk kicked the ball 19 times in the semi-final. Like,
do you know what's interesting? I had a thought when he was doing that, you know, and I was thinking back to the Aviva Stadium, not to navel gaze here and make it all about us, but it is interesting that this very conservative game plan has won a World Cup, given the criticisms of Ireland in 2019 that we're now too conservative.
It is amazing.
You know, let those two float around for a moment, but it was interesting in that watching de Klerk kick, and even against England as well, where they were winning contestable box kicks, and you think back to the Aviva, when England were so on the money when it came to escorting Irish runners and blocking them from chasing Conor Murray box kicks. And suddenly, 6-7 months later, they've almost forgot the emphasis on that. And South Africa were contesting kicks and it was causing England trouble. It's just very interesting to compare those two games.
Yeah, I think England felt as though there was a big evolution of their game from when they played against us in Lansdowne Road. Yes, it was that attritional game, but at the same time, they still had that ability to get into the wider channels and score tries as they did against us, but when they did it so effectively in the warm-up games and then they did it so well against New Zealand, is why would you revert away from something that's given you huge success? And then their kick game was disappointing in the final. The bit of ball that they did get, they didn't kick well, they didn't get their, you know, fair share of 50-50s. I think the South African back three owned that space. And if you look at other, you know, the two tries that they picked up, there weren't a huge amount of other try-scoring opportunities created by South Africa, being brutally honest. Mm. But they just took them brilliantly, and we've got a slightly inflated view of maybe how the game actually went.
Well, the Colby one's not really a team try.
It's a turnover. It's a great shot from Marks on Henry Slade, who came on and coughed up a couple of balls. Mm. And Peter Steph Tatoy gets it away to... Am flicks it to Peter Steph Tatoy, who shifts it on to Colby, and you could feel as though what was going to happen unfolded. Mm. But you're helpless to that, because the last thing you want to do if you're Owen Farrell is get smoked on the outside. Mm. It's like you can't. You've got to use that touchline as much as you can. Now, you've got to offer enough of it to discourage someone from coming inside, but then at the risk of getting burnt, you know, between you and the touchline at the same time. So it's a fine line.
Yeah.
Farrell was a bit nervous about his speed, so he probably pushed to the touchline a bit too aggressively. And then with that wicked step and the ability to... Usually when you get a shot on someone on your inside shoulder, it's enough for the hustle coming across to pick up that defend or that attacker, whereas Farrell didn't get any sort of impact on him. He barely stopped his momentum. And it was Marler, Vunipola and Dan Cole, I think, were on the hustle, and there was the problem.
Yeah,
that they were all out of steam at that stage. That was the thing about Dan Cole as well. 78 minutes he had to play. You never want to play a tight head prop for 78 minutes.
A few things you kind of read and hear when people are looking for answers across the week. So, for instance, that Jones and the game plan was fixated on New Zealand, and he hadn't really given how to beat South Africa much thought in the build-up to the World Cup. I don't know if you can deduce that from watching the final. And also, I heard someone make the point, I can't remember who, but somebody was saying that maybe Ford and Farrell against this South African team, unlike against New Zealand, was not the right combination, that really you needed more heft in midfield. And as nice as it is to have the two playmakers on, this was a game to have Farrell at 10 and get more heft in midfield against that South African team. Is there much Jones or England could have done better here?
If they played this weekend, bet you it's not the same scoreline.
Same teams, though?
Yeah, same teams.
Okay.
Like you can pull it apart one way or another, but the reality is that those two teams play each other in a three-test series. It'd be very hard to call it. Would it be outrageous to think that England could go and win 2-1, having gone 1-0 down? No, it wouldn't, because of the quality of players. It just didn't happen for them on the day. They didn't get the platform in the set piece, which is a very simplified version of things, and that has a huge impact on the game. Mm. You know, for the purists out there, they would have been, Mike Rosses of the world would have been absolutely licking his lips at what was happening there.
I was thinking at the half-time against Northampton.
I thought about it too, and the need to fix it, because it had such a detrimental effect on England's performance. You knock a ball on, scrum down, yes, scrum penalty, kick a 3 points, or 50 metres up the pitch.
Just hanging over you the whole time.
It is. It's just, yeah. And then you get a bit tighter, maybe as well, with the knowledge that don't make a mistake, don't knock it on because we're in trouble in the scrum.
Yeah. So to kind of round things off then in South Africa as champions, there's, you know, you kind of talk about, well, are they good champions for the game? Now, we talked at the start of the tournament about the cloud hanging over the doping culture in the country. So that's one aspect of it, and we've talked about it, and people are uneasy about it, to say the least, and the emerging World Player of the Year test positive 2 months before the tournament. That is not good, to say the least. So there's that. And then also there's the style of play. So style of play?
Well, style of play,
is that good for the game that succeeded?
For new eyeballs, certainly not as effective as the way we saw Japan play the game. You know, if you're looking at trying to... And that was one thing. I'll come back to that. One thing about Japan, about trying to interest a nation that maybe don't know an awful lot about rugby. How do you play? The South African way or the Japanese way? The Japanese way. And they were absolutely breath of fresh air. So when you look at those contrasts, of course you would go with the Japanese version. But then you've got to play to your strengths as well. And you look back on World Cup winning teams, and with the greatest respect to the South African team, you look back to 03 England, the quality of that team, even the 07 team, South African team, those, you know, phenomenal players mixed throughout, New Zealand 11 and 15 teams. And then you've got this team, which are a very good rugby team, but all of a sudden, you know, they lose one game to New Zealand at the start, and then win the rest of their pool matches. They get Japan, Wales, and then beat England in a final. They're world champions, and they're now obviously considered the same as everybody else. But on paper, you mightn't have thought that they were of that caliber. Mm. But it doesn't matter. You don't have to be the best team in the world. You just have to be the best team in the tournament.
Yeah, and the form lines are all over the shop, and it just worked out for them. And does it follow? Because say, for instance, in GAA, quite often, success, people copy success. So a certain style of football wins, everyone does it, the blanket defences and so on. Does it necessarily follow, do you suspect, in rugby, that in the way teams might look at New Zealand, where they win World Cups and think we need to chase after that, do you think teams will be looking at this African style and saying, well, that's the way to get it done?
Not everyone can play like that.
Because you don't have the size.
I sat at a table right beside them at the World Rugby Awards on Sunday night. They are superhuman. They are enormous, absolutely enormous. They're 4 second rows. That when you've got 14 forwards that are going to come on over an 80-minute period, these are giants. Marks is absolutely huge, beast. Matawira at one, huge, huge men. So I don't think you've now got a brand that everyone will look to play.
Japan can't say, geez, we've been getting it wrong.
They don't have the personnel for that.
What about Ireland? I'm going to play Johnny Sexton in just a second. He was speaking today in Cardiff at the Champions Cup launch. So the conservatism of South Africa and then Ireland, you know, it's kind of hard to say with the same certainty that, geez, well, Ireland, conservatives, rugby just doesn't work.
Well, if you put it, if you look at it this way, the way Wales played against South Africa in the semi-final, were Ireland capable of playing to that standard?
Yes.
Yes, they were.
Yeah.
And they lost by 3 points. So by the letter of that law, you know, if Ireland had gotten the better route to, you know, a perceived final via winning the group, not being beaten by Japan, winning the group, getting South Africa in a quarter-final, is it inconceivable, even in the poor form that they had, that they couldn't have beaten them? It's not inconceivable. I think it looked unlikely, but it's not inconceivable.
Yeah.
So I think that adds to the pain of those players, of the realisation that they were, because they were 10 or 15% off, that was the difference between an opportunity and a shot at getting a Wales in a semi-final.
And what you could certainly say is, if they were in good form playing that style of game,
for sure.
You know.
For sure.
Let's have a look at Johnny Sexton. So Neil Tracy was over in Cardiff. The Heineken Champions Cup launch was today. Johnny Sexton was there, obviously. Saracens weren't there. We'll come to that in a moment. We'll have Champions Cup again this season here on Off the Ball. First weekend, we'll have the Leinster match and the Ulster matches in weekend one. So that's in, 10 days' time. But here's Johnny Sexton speaking in Cardiff today.
Johnny Sexton, I suppose so. Welcome back from the World Cup and all that. What have the last couple of weeks been like? I imagine a lot of self-reflection over the way things went in Japan.
Yeah, very disappointing, obviously, a couple of weeks. Probably take longer than a couple of weeks to get over the disappointment, but the only thing you can do now is just focus back into the next thing and try and make a success of that.
Have you been able to put your finger on why it went the way it did?
Yeah, we didn't play well enough on the day against New Zealand.
And have you been able to kind of identify, you know, the things leading up to this over the last year? Is it something over the last couple of months that started to go wrong, or when you think about it, was it something that for the last year hasn't really been right?
No, it wasn't a year in total. Obviously, it was a failure because we didn't do what we wanted to do. We didn't have any, we didn't win any trophies or anything like that. But it wasn't all bad. There was some good performances in there trade. It's just we lost that consistency that we had before, and we had some poor performances, and the margins are pretty small, even against New Zealand. I thought we were in a great place going into it. We had sort of built our way from that Japan game, obviously, and we still knew that we were going to be in a quarter final, and I thought we were building towards it, but we couldn't produce our best on the day.
Is it worse than 4 years ago?
Well, it's the exact same, isn't it? We lost. We didn't win the World Cup, so it's the exact same.
And you're back now, and are you expecting... There's Dan Lediot, good friend of yours. He was telling me all about you, actually, there. You close family connections between the two of you now, actually.
Yeah, my wife is godmother to his daughter, and his wife is godmother to our second, I think. First or second. Yeah, we lived together in Paris for a couple of years, so we became great mates.
And I suppose where I was just going to go there was back into the Heineken Champions Cup now in the next couple of weeks. Do you think you're going to be back to play in that game against Benetton? Are you expecting, like, physically, are you feeling up to getting back to rugby?
I hope so, yeah. I can't wait to get back into it. We did a lot of hard work over the pre-season physically, and obviously didn't get to see the best of it over the World Cup, but looking forward to getting back into now a new campaign, and back in with the lads has been great over the last week, really. We've been in just getting back used to the calls and the systems, and getting back into the way we do things in Leinster. It's obviously quite different to the Irish setup, so just get bedding back in and getting ready for a big, feels like the start of a season, you know what I mean?
As you said there, you were saying it's nice to get back with Leinster. There have been people over the last couple of weeks suggesting maybe that, players from different provinces being used to different systems, when they were involved with Ireland, they were just kind of not as comfortable playing that particular way. Is that something you'd go along with?
Well, that's the big challenge for any international team, isn't it? That they have to adapt to that system, and you've got four other different systems, All the provinces play differently, and trying to get them and play the Irish way. And we didn't do that well enough this year.
Has it been nice to actually just get back out there and get a bit of time in the legs out on the pitch with all the Leinster lads? And I suppose it's kind of like pulling off a plaster or something. You can kind of just try park it for a little while.
Oh, it feels like just the start of a season, really. Now, and, obviously the World Cup almost feels like it was last season. We've had a bit of a break. And now it's just starting afresh again, And obviously the World Cup will be, still there. It'll be in the back of our minds like it will be for a long time. But, there's nothing we can do about that now. We'll talk about it. We'll review it when the time is right. And we will, learn from it. And but at the moment, all my focus is on Leinster and getting us off to a good European start.
Another big decision Andy Farrell has to make, obviously, when he come in, is his new captain. That's something you've done in bits and pieces over the last couple of years with Ireland. Was that something you'd like to do, or would you think it'd be maybe something for one of the younger guys to kind of have there for, the guts of a decade, someone who's going to be around that long?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I haven't spoke to Andy about it. I got the privilege of doing it from the start once against Russia. I've done it in games when Rory wasn't in Australia and Pete went off at 50 minutes in one game and then went off injured early in another game. I did it in France last year in the when we won the Grand Slam when Rory went off. So I've done it. But again, it's up to Andy what way he wants to go. If he wants to go with someone that's younger and sort of build the team around them for the next, yeah, like you said, next decade. Look, that's not up for me to decide or to speculate or to throw my hat in the ring. I'm sure he's got his own ideas what he wants to do and how he wants the team to be led. And yeah, look, we'll speak about that in or I'm sure he'll speak about it in December whenever he gets the group back together.
Are you looking forward to working with him? He's obviously someone, you know, not just from Ireland the last couple of years, but from Lions experiences down the years as well.
Yeah, he's a great coach. He's a great man as well. So I've got to know him over the last 6 years with the Lions, two Lions tours, and working with Ireland, and I've loved working with him, and I'm excited to see what changes he makes. You know, we have a new attack coach in Mike Catt, but Andy has coached attack before, and I'm sure he'll sort of mix and match with Mike in that regard, and do everything together. And look, it's always exciting when you get a fresh voice, a new coach at any stage of your career, and at the stage I'm at, I'm always keen to learn and keep improving. And you know, I'm hopeful the two guys will teach us some new things.
And finally, first game of the Champions Cup, then Benetton Treviso, a side that have shown the last couple of years they've absolutely no fear of Leinster whatsoever.
Yeah, they've beaten us 2 years ago in the RDS. They've drawn with us last season in the RDS, so they'll sort of have fond memories of the RDS. They're a very good team. They're the first team to qualify on merit, and I'm sure that'll motivate them, that they want to prove that they deserve to be here. Well, they proved that already, but they want to sort of stamp their mark on this tournament. They always take some scalps in the tournament. You know, I remember them beating Toulouse and Perpignan and these type of teams down in Treviso, but you know, it's going to be an incredibly tough game, and one that we're going to have to be really ready for.
Johnny, thanks many for speaking to us, and very best of luck.
Cheers.
Johnny Sexton there, still clearly disappointed. I don't think there will be long answers forthcoming from him on what went wrong at the World Cup, that's for sure, anytime soon. He did touch on something that yourself and Issa Nasewa in different ways kind of threw out there into the ether. And I think more so you as a theory, and Issa Nasewa was almost implying he'd been talking to teammates, which was that the Lancaster approach, certainly in 2018, Nasewa was almost suggesting it was more a part of the Irish performances. And then in 2019, Joe Schmidt reverted to a more conservative game plan, and Leinster continued to play the comfortable and chaos multi-phase kind of game, and maybe they were looking longingly back at Leinster. Can you clarify where you were coming from in that? Were you saying something pretty similar?
Yeah, I think with Joe, over the course of his tenure with Leinster and then his early years with Ireland, he had huge success. So you look at the comparisons to other coaches within the provincial setup when he was there, and the national team, they weren't firing, whereas, you know, his Leinster team were. Mm. And then subsequently, you know, the national team really started firing when the provincial sides weren't.
Yeah.
You know, certainly the first two or three years of it. And so from that point of view, I think you get player buy-in 100%.
Yes.
When they realise this is the way that it needs to be done. And then you have another coach come in, you know, during that period, and you see another version of the gospel, and you quite like it, and it's fun to play, and it's just a different way of thinking and seeing the game.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, Joe has a challenge. I always remember there was very few occasions where we had a great provincial setup and a brilliant national setup. You usually had a preference for one or the other, or one was just a little bit more enjoyable. And that might have been because of the success or because of just, you know, the group of players or whatever, but rarely were both of them humming.
Yeah.
Whereas that was the case with Leinster, where both of them were absolutely flying. We had Ireland with the with the Grand Slam year, with being unbeaten, go down to Australia, and then we had Leinster also winning the European Cup that year. So players just had a taste of something different, and I think they liked it.
Mm.
And I'm saying that more so from, you know, from looking from the outside rather than necessarily speaking to players.
I see. I wasn't sure if this was something you heard.
No, this is not something that I've heard.
Okay.
It's something that I feel as though it looks as though it's a viable reason.
Okay.
For the slight drop off, or for I'm not saying that the belief was lost, but I just think that there was, we saw an evolution of Leinster over the course of the first few years of Lancaster, whereas the evolution of Ireland probably wasn't to the same degree over that period of time.
Yeah.
It was the same thing, just done better. Mm. Whereas Leinster evolved, and we saw guys becoming offloaders and passers that we haven't seen for 7 or 8 years.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what comes out. Joe Schmidt's releasing a book as well. So, I mean, how much detail he goes into what he feels went wrong is going to be fascinating. The defeat in Newcastle in the Heineken Champions Cup to Saracens, I mean, say they're all buying into, and we're going on a theory here to a degree, but say they're all buying into this way, and this is brilliant, this is the way to go, and geez, we've just been beaten by England and Wales in the Six Nations. I mean, Saracens did a pretty good number on them in that final, so that might have been a chance where they could have said, OK, well, it's not like this necessarily works either. Let's trust in Joe Schmidt. So,
yeah, but that's a one-off. These are one-off games, too. We can't completely let slide our opinions on the basis.
Weren't England and Wales pretty? Wasn't the Six Nations a fairly brief period as well? That's a one-off game.
Well, Leinster are a different team to Ireland, so I don't think you can compare team. You know, you can only talk team to team. But, you know, Leinster had huge success in the way they played the previous year.
So did Ireland.
Yeah, but, you know, yeah, fair point. But I think if Leinster go and play against that Saracens team, similarly to what we said about England and South Africa, you know, in three consecutive weeks, there's no way you could guarantee that Saracens are going to win 3 weeks on the bounce. You might have, you know, that style being very effective another week against that Saracens side. So...
There's still questions.
Yeah, like I don't know the answers to it, to be brutally honest. Yeah. But it's just...
It was a thought you had.
Yeah, yeah. That's all. I feel like I'm talking myself into a hole here, but
well, not for the first time. The time. Saracens didn't turn up today. They're fairly livid at the situation. Dock 35 points, fine more than £5 million, pending an appeal. So what's happened here is, this has been told, this is kind of almost open secret territory to a degree, that breaking the salary cap is the wrong way of putting it, but certainly they were being creative in their partnerships between Nigel Ray and the players. So about 9 months ago, Premiership Rugby decided to look into this. And their finding is that Saracens failed to disclose payments to players in each of the last 3 seasons. And it says the club also exceeded the ceiling for payments to senior players in that time. So Nigel Ray, the owner chairman, he was involved in companies such as Vun Prop Limited, which was Mako and Billy Vunipola, Faz Investments Limited, which was Owen Farrell, Wiggy Nine Limited, Richard Wigglesworth. So they certainly weren't trying to disguise it with the names. Mm-hmm. We can say that much. And he's arguing that this was an investment and not a salary. And the people who've looked into this have said, come off it. We're not having that. So they've slapped them with probably an unprecedented points deduction. I mean, 35 points.
I think it's the max they could have gone.
Is it really? Well, Rob Baxter today said, if this is upheld, it's obvious those titles have been won unfairly. I mean, if it's upheld, it's absolutely an extraordinary punishment for them. I'm sure lawyers will be all over this. There's going to be an appeal. This could end up in Cass, absolutely, and maybe they'll meet in the middle. Have you anything to add on this or any read on this?
This has been touted for quite a number of years. This is not a rumour that sprung from nowhere. And you know, it's interesting, I read an article today from Chris Robshaw, and he seemed particularly annoyed. And someone put it, you know, doesn't seem an awful lot that gets Chris Robshaw really riled up, but this was one thing. And he felt as though over the course of Quinn's won in 2012, and all of a sudden, because of the salary cap, they weren't able to keep the level. As their profiles rose with that success, you know, so needed their you know, income to rise and so on, and interest in other clubs. And so they weren't able to pick and choose, maybe, to keep all the players that they had wanted to keep. And who was it in the backs? I remember Brown, Manya, and Jordan Turner Hull were the ones to sign first. But the one to lose out was David Strettle, because his profile was rising. And where did he go? To Saracens. And Robshaw, you know, or this article made reference to, they felt as though Conor O'Shea was squeezed out of the club because he simply felt as though he couldn't compete with what was going on. So this has been a dirty secret for a while, and not so much of a secret. And the talk is that there's other clubs that you know potentially have a case to answer as well. And this isn't solely Saracens that the inquiry is going to be around. So we'll have to wait and see. There's a lot to be played, more to be played out in this, but. Yeah, it's a pretty tough week for those Saracens core group of players coming back from losing a World Cup final. They thought they were going to be showcasing the William Webb Ellis around London, and all of a sudden now they've been hit with this 5 days later.
Meanwhile, on one more point on Sexton, Leinster away to Connacht on Friday, Munster host Ulster on the Saturday, and then it's Champions Cup the following week. Coming back from World Cup. I mean, on the face of it, Ireland, Irish provinces have often done very well. Munster won the Lantern Cup in 2008. Leinster, one of their great seasons, 2012, after the 11 World Cup, that win against Ulster and Twickenham. So things have generally turned out okay quite often. Was it a bit grim, a bit of an anticlimax, tough to get motivated? Do you feel good physically because you're in the shape of your life, or do you feel like, geez, I need another break? What was your experience of coming back from World Cups?
The more difficult, the older you got. I obviously was different in 2011 because I went and got a neck fusion immediately. I knew I couldn't continue playing the way I was during that World Cup, so I knew something had to be done. And I wasn't sure was that going to be the end for me if would I come back from a neck fusion. So it was slightly different. I was relieved at getting this operation because these pins and needles had become the norm. I look back to previous World Cups, back to 99 with Lens, that disappointment, you're new on the scene, you're just excited about playing.
Sure.
And I heard someone say, met Jordan Larmour, and he was just excited about getting back playing for Leinster, and that's just youthful enthusiasm because yes. More rugby is better.
It can vary where you are. Some lads have been kicking their heels on a bench.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas Johnny's point of view, he's not going to be around for the next World Cup. You know, he's 34 years of age. Mm. And you could see the disappointment etched in his face that the reality that they had their best ever opportunity to get to a semi-final at least, and it went up in flames within 10 minutes, 15 minutes against the All Blacks.
Yeah.
And he's someone that wears his heart on his sleeve and he lives it, you know, in his day-to-day life as well, Johnny. And everyone feels as though they put 100% in, but his 100% feels like a different level of intensity. And so when... You know, he has the success, you can feel the joy, but more so the lows and the disappointments, he really lives them, and it'll be a while before he parks that.
Yeah. And interesting to see if some players have hangovers or if it's fuel and what you do with that disappointment. And even looking at him there, you wonder to what extent they have clear ideas in their head about what went wrong. They're not going to share them with us quite clearly, but you wonder if some of them are racking their brains a little bit and saying, what the hell went wrong, and do you let that consume you? Maybe the fact that there's a new man in, Andy Farrell, helps, although he is still part of the old regime.
Mm. Yeah, when they do meet in December, I wonder, do they pull their World Cup apart, or do they, you know, start a new slate? It'd be interesting to see what comes of that.
Is Farrell on the back foot, in your opinion, now, because he was such a big part of the previous regime?
No, I don't think so. I think he's entitled to a clean slate himself and be treated fresh from the previous management. I think he's a very likeable guy, very approachable guy. I met him actually a few days before the before the World Cup final, and I had a quick chat to him, and I said, obviously hard luck, and he said, yeah, and I said, well, I suppose you've got some sort of excitement about Owen this weekend. Looked at me. I said, okay, maybe as the current Irish head coach, I can understand that.
And
he didn't take an awful lot of convincing that he was a man that very much felt disappointed, and that it was more so about him rather than what might come at the weekend with his son. Of course, I'm sure his wife had slightly split loyalties.
I'd say it was with Owen.
But
pretty much.
But yeah, but he's very passionate about what he does, and I think he'll go well. Actually, I think he'll go well. I do. I think he's got a rebuilding process, no doubt, and he's got to be brave in the short term, but also with an eye to the long term.
Because, well, it'll be fascinating to see how he approaches it, because obviously if results go badly initially, then suddenly, this is because he's associated with the previous regime, and, you know, geez, in hindsight, we should have had a clear out, and all that stuff can start very quickly, unfortunately, whether it's fair or not. and allied to the fact that Ireland's defence has been criticised heavily over the last year, 18 months, and that's been his department. Mm. So that's in the ether, I think, a little bit.
Yeah, and listen, there's question marks around him as a head coach, no doubt, and will he have the answers? Mm. But I think, first of all, you hear the players talk about him. They've got huge respect for him as a coach, but as a person as well. And I think that does carry weight. And straight away, he'll have buy-in. And what will be intriguing is to see what the process of, sifting some of the older brigade and bringing in new blood and the time scale over which he does that as well.
That was the last question, because it was funny, I was watching all this from afar, and you see, oh, it's so much analysis, and various people are saying, well, we just have not got this 4-year cycle thing cracked. And by the same token, they're talking about World Cup champions who were in disarray 2 years ago, didn't know what the hell was going on, had no plan, no cycle, no nothing, and actually it can just come together quite quickly and things can go well. Like, I'm not sure to what extent you can plan 4 years in sport. Mm. It just seems impossible.
Yeah, it's got to be two-year cycles, surely.
2 year cycles.
We beat South Africa 38-3.
Yeah.
Less than 2 years ago.
And it was one of those moments where I thought, geez, well, we can write them off for the World Cup. Mm. Now, who have we got left? So I wonder with Farrell, do you look at the likes of a Sexton and a Rob Kearney and various people of that ilk, and you say, well, they're not around for the World Cup, therefore, let's rip this plaster off early doors and start the new process? Or do you say, we take this 1 year at a time?
I think provided there's players in those positions that are capable of coming through and doing a good job immediately. I don't think you can bring players in that have some potential, because the long-term focus will kill the short-term situation and results.
Yes.
And that will ultimately have a say in how long he stays in the job.
Yeah.
So I think he won't be thinking about World Cups yet. He'll be thinking about how can I get the most out of this team next year, and what players will help me get the performances and the results that I'm looking for, and then how does my integration work into that as well?
Mm. There's no point going right.
No,
tear it
there's up. No way, because in reality, it's not as though there's 15 players waiting in the wings, going, pick me.
Yeah.
The squad, other than two or three positions, sort of picked itself. Mm-hmm. So you have to be a little bit careful with that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, in the same breath, some of those senior players that have been there a long time have to be very careful as well, because if there's similar performances than we've seen over the course of the last year, other lads will be given their opportunities.
Okay, great stuff. Thanks, Emil.
Cheers.
Brian O'Driscoll on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.